Blog Talk Radio.
Thousands of offices, slashing service, and want to lay off over 100,000 workers.
The Postal Service is recording financial losses, but not for reasons you might think. The problem? A burden no other agency or company bears. A 2006 law that drains $5 billion a year from post office revenue, while the Postal Service is forced to overpay billions more into federal accounts. Congress created this problem, and Congress can fix it.
And in the big finish tonight, thanks to Republicans in Congress, the United States Postal Service is in danger of collapse. How nice of them. The Republican philosophy is privatization. We know that. And they are destroying the Postal Service to get their way. The Post Office reported a $15.9 billion loss through their fiscal year ending September 30th, 2012. It's important to keep in mind the Post Office is losing money because of a 2006 law passed in a lame duck session of the Congress by the Republicans. The law requires the Post Office to pre-fund employees' retirement accounts for the next 75 years in a 10-year window. I wonder if Mitt Romney would say that's a good business plan. These overpayments make up $11 billion of this year's net loss. Now, the other $5 billion is in decline, is because of the decline in mailing that's taken place in operations, but it would have been manageable. Both of these problems can easily be fixed. In April, the Senate passed a bill allowing the Postal Service to regain $11 billion in overpayments to its retirement account. The bill, of course, went nowhere. Speaker John Boehner in the House, he didn't want anything to do with it. Meanwhile, the revenue problem can be solved by modernizing the Postal Service. The great Bernie Sanders says, here's what we can do about it. Here's the plan.
Clearly, the Postal Service has to change. It has to be much more entrepreneurial, much more pro-business, much more pro-consumer. In our state of Vermont, we have many rural post offices. People want to go there to get letters copied. Can't do that. They want to get letters notarized against the law. They want a fishing license. They want a hunting license against the law. There are many areas where the Postal Service can expand, bring in substantially more revenue.
And this is breaking news. No tax dollars go to the operation of the Postal Service. That's right. $0. These solutions are simple, but Republicans are against helping the Post Office because they want to see it eliminated, bust the union, privatize it, make a dollar on the side for their buddies. The longer nothing is done, more jobs are lost, and the economy suffers. Currently, the Postal Service has plans to close 260 post offices around the country. So that's what's happening to the one in your town. This means that an additional 35,000 postal jobs are at risk if nothing is done by this session, lame duck session of the Congress. Republicans' inaction on this issue is absolutely shameless. They've had all year to come to the table to work with the Democrats, but of course they haven't done it. They are hell-bent on seeing the U.S. Postal Service die, even if it means destroying a great American institution. In the process, they don't care. They want it privatized. It's wrong. Let's turn to Greg Bell, Vice President of the American Postal Workers Union. Mr. Bell, good to have you with us tonight. What is the number one thing that can be done right now to save the Postal Service as we know it?
Well, the number one thing that must be done is to eliminate the unrealistic mandate that the Postal Service currently had to pre-fund future retiree health care benefits for a 75-year period within a 10-year period. That's the number one. That's the main cause of the Postal Service problems. Matter of fact, that is the cause. If you remove that liability, the Postal Service, as you stated, would be able to assume the responsibility without any type of assistance or any type of additional funds.
And I want to emphasize here that this is going to financially butcher small business in America, in rural America. What are they going to do? Their shipping costs are going to go through the roof. Their line item is going to go off the page because all of the privatization is not going to be able to cover and service rural America, which the Post Office does right now for many of these companies. Mr. Bell, it's good to have you with us tonight. It's a story that I want to tell over and over again. I want this lame duck session of the Congress to do something about this. It is unfair. Mitt Romney would never run any of his businesses like that. That's what you Republicans need to know. That's the Ed Show. I'm Ed Schultz on this Friday night. The Rachel Maddow Show starts right now.
know the plug for MSNBC, but, you know, I don't want to say anything. I can't seem to shut this off. Here we go. That says it all, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it really does. And this is the problem that we face is, you know, I personally, I'm not working in a union at this point, but Lila does. She works for the ASPE union. She's a member. And, you know, I know many, many people that are. And I have worked in several unions in my life, but jobs. But the thing that concerns me so is how, we can be so duped, okay, into by these Republicans and by these people who think Republicans have the means, okay. I mean, the Postal Service makes no sense that they have to pay for pensions for, you know, for the next 75 years. Okay, for future employees that don't even exist yet, right? I mean, you know, within the next 10 years. I mean, that is their way of crushing the Postal Service, crushing it, okay, and destroying it. But if they destroy that service, they also destroy America. They destroy a major backbone of America. Schultz mentioned the rural areas that aren't even serviced. Many people don't realize that only about 2/3 of this country even has internet service. Okay, really, so many areas do not. There's so many rural communities that are not serviced this way. In the South, you know. Or, you know, different communities everywhere. But, you know, our communications grid, if you will, okay, it needs to be updated. But for some reason, and God only knows why, the Republicans only know why they're not, you know, expanding these things. I mean, our mass transit is in total disrepair. Our, you know, bridges are in disrepair. Our, you know, our communication systems, our electric systems, are just desperate need. Okay, our nuclear power plants are all outdated. They're all old. They're all running on expired permits. Okay, they're all leaking. All right, it's just obscene. Okay, and we spend trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of our taxpayer money to foreign banks, to bail out foreign banks, okay, or to bail out the banksters in this country. And yet we can't find the money to build our own country, to rebuild our country, to help the citizens, help the retired, to pay for Social Security benefits, health insurance, these kind of things. We have the money. We just have the bastards in government that aren't willing to, you know, to focus, you know, or to spend it properly. And I'm including Obama right down to the, you know, to this jerk, which I'm going to read about now. Kentucky unions rally to Grimes and drive to ditch Mitch. Okay. Now, Mitch McConnell is probably one of the deepest entrenched, miserable schmucks that ever sat in public office in the Senate. But let me read you this. Allison Lundergan Grimes started her stump speech to union members, local Democratic Party officials, and others in Paducah, Kentucky, with a quote from Senator Mitch McConnell. "Public sector unions are a 50-year mistake. Unions are to blame for distrust of our government. Unions are power-hungry and no longer serve the public interest. Then the 34-year-old Democrat who wants McConnell's job lowered the boom. She said he didn't realize what he was describing was how Kentuckians feel about service in Washington. And, the crowds inside Walker Hall Events Center loved the jab. They clapped, cheered, whistled, and laughed, and Grimes got more of the same throughout her speech and earned a standing ovation at the end. The Grimes-McConnell matchup is expected to be one of the most closely watched Senate races next year. That's assuming McConnell turns back Tea Party challenger Matt Bevin in the May 2014 Republican primary. Well, Grimes, Kentucky Secretary of State, was in Paducah for the annual pre-fancy farm luncheon sponsored by the West Kentucky Building and Construction Trades. The Paducah feed was Grimes' warm-up for the state's biggest political picnic held the next day at Little Fancy Farm near Paducah. It was the first time Grimes, McConnell, and Bevin crossed paths on what will be a lengthy campaign trail. Bevin also spoke. So did Democrat Ed Marksbury, one of Grimes' challengers, in the primary. And many union members helped swell the Grimes cheering section at the 133rd annual Fancy Farm Picnic, which features barbecue and politics, both spicy hot. And this year, the Grimes-McConnell-Bevin feud drew hefty coverage from the national media. The retired history teacher wonders if President Franklin Delano Roosevelt inspired a key part of Grimes' speech. The reminiscent of FDR's famous Martin, Barton, and Fish refrain from 1940, Grimes got her supporters chorusing, "Stop now." She did likewise at the luncheon and earlier at a big rally in Lexington, Kentucky. Going on 73 years ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was running for an historic third term. Grimes took many history, could make history too if she wins. She would be the first woman to occupy a Senate seat from the Bluegrass State. In one of his most memorable stem winders, Roosevelt made political hay of GOP reps, and he tagged the trio, Martin, Bruce, Barton, and Hamilton Fish, as obstructionists bent on thwarting his plans to provide vital military aid for the British. Well, this article goes on. It's written by a history professor, so it's kind of boring. But the important thing is he states that this lady, Alison Grimes, may be the figure that stands up for unions. At least in Kentucky, and may knock out Mitch McConnell, which would be a wonderful, wonderful service to all humanity. So anyway, my take on that. I want to go back a couple of places here. The puzzle of the unemployment rate, and this might be worth listening to, because if you consider that this country has created 943,000 jobs in the last couple of years, but they don't realize that 700,000 of those are part-time jobs. We're not getting full-time jobs anymore. This recession is killing us. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its latest report on job market on August 2nd. It had some good news for African Americans. The black unemployment rate has just dipped to 12.6%. Its lowest level since January of 2009. The Bureau of Labor Statistics also reported that since August 2012, the unemployment rate for adult black men, those older than 20, remained below its 14.4 level in January 2009, and was reported to be 12.5 in July. More importantly, the share of black men holding jobs continues to rebound from its record low of 56.5% in 2011 to 59.2%, almost equal its level of 60%. So this means that almost half of all the black men in this country are unemployed. It's unbelievable. The bad news was that the unemployment rate for adult black women, those older than 20, remained above its January 2009 level, though it did fall to 10.5%. And the share of adult black women holding jobs at 55.5% is not showing much improvement to return to its 2000 level of 57.9%. Since more than half of the black workforce is female, it means the labor market news was mixed at best. That's absolutely staggering. The big puzzle is looking at the changes in the black unemployment rate is the fact that black labor forces is older now than during past major turndowns in the mid-1970s, early 1980s. In 1975, the black unemployment rate spiked to 14.4%. In 1982 and 1983, black unemployment rate skyrocketed to over 20% for a nine-month period starting in October 1982. Those were tough years for the early 80s. Were terrible, horrible recession period, if you remember. They don't mention here that, mortgage rates, that Mr. Reagan came in, Mr. Union Buster, tried to stop inflation by raising the mortgage interest rates to 20%, I mean, he killed the housing market, he absolutely killed it, it didn't come back till almost 5 years later. In terms of the overall unemployment rate rise and the drop in the size of the economy, the Great Recession turndown of 2008 was much more severe than both the 75 and 82 turndowns, and the black unemployment rate reached 16.8% in March of 2010. That's staggering. And this, today the labor force participation of young black workers is very low. So they do not influence the overall black unemployment rate as much today. Only 37% of black teens were employed or actively looking for work in July. That is, in the labor force and counted in the unemployment rate. Almost 60% of black teens are unemployed. Not even looking for it. And it's staggering. I mean, this article goes on, but what it fails to mention, but I received it from another article, which I'll go to in a second. I'm going to try to find it here. I was hoping to find this for you, but I thought I posted it, but I didn't. Sorry, folks. I don't have that particular So, but anyway, I would like to read one more article before we go to a little music break. But bear with me, folks, one second. I'm just trying to travel through this.
greater purchasing power, they in turn will be able to demand more goods and services.
And as they do this, businesses will produce more and in turn hire more workers, which may have the inevitable result of bidding up wages across the board. This was the basic macroeconomic argument that underpinned the Fair Labor Standards Act when it was passed in 1938. But because there are wage contour effects in an increase in the minimum wage can be expected to have ripple effects through much of the wage distribution. Therefore, the minimum wage not only benefits those at the top of the distribution, but the larger middle class. This is important because conservatives like to justify their anti-statist approach to economic and social problems on the basis of what benefits the middle class. Of course, they claim that lower taxes will benefit the middle class, as they will effectively give workers more purchasing power. But a minimum wage that benefits the middle class and has the macroeconomic benefit of increasing aggregate demand for goods and services and ultimately more jobs, which should also lead to lower taxes, because more people working should lead to fewer living off the largesse of the state. In other words, the conservative case for the minimum wage rests on the assumption that the positive welfare effects of the minimum wage will lead to less redistribution. This stuff is bullshit, but, you know, Milton Friedman used to argue the redistribution was bad because it infringed individual liberty. But, you know, I can't stand... I'm sorry that I got into this article, because I can't stand these kind of writers, think tank writers. I mean, whether they work for some socialist blogger or some liberal college or some school in London economics or something. Or a head writer for a union, they just drive and they kill their own concepts. The concept of minimum wage, nice and easy. Okay. I mean, he's saying that it helps the middle class. It doesn't even put. I mean, people making minimum wage today are barely making it. Okay, who the hell can make it on $7.35 an hour? You know. You can't even afford to. I mean, here in Connecticut, somebody has said that in order to afford an apartment, okay, you have to be making $12 to $14, I believe, and it's $14 an hour. That's double what the minimum wage is. Okay, so anybody working for minimum wage today is either living with their parents, living with somebody else, or homeless. Imagine that. Working 40 hours and being homeless, all right, because you can't afford to live anywhere. But, you know, this is the problem with this conservative mentality. Okay? This is the stupidity of this Republican Tea Party, tutelage. It is just stupid. You know, it's just completely stupid. And unless you... Yes, you have to have minimum wage. But minimum wage should be a livable wage. And there's much talk about that today, everywhere. I mean, what is livable wage? $10 an hour? $12 an hour? $15 an hour? Well, depending on what area you live in, it could be as much as $20 or $25 an hour, okay? Just to afford shelter, clothing, and, basic necessities, a car, like here in Connecticut, the minimum wage is $7.35 or some the same amount of money, some low pay, and it's going up next year or the year after to $8 or $8.50 or who the hell knows. But the key is that it still doesn't pay. I mean, it still doesn't make enough money for somebody to work 40 hours a week and more. Okay. They can't even make ends meet at minimum wage. And what unions do, God bless the union, is punch that up to a livable wage. Give people benefits, give people vacations, give people paid vacations, health care. make these damn employers pay for their workers and pay their workers and allow them to live, not be slaves, you know, to a company store. You know what I mean? So, yeah, anyway. I don't want to go into a rant here, but, you know, I get very angry when I read these comments and poorly, you know, I didn't want to read this whole thing. I did want to explain a conservative theory, but again, I get so disappointed by so many writers. They just seem to babble at the mouth. I'm going to go to a quick music break, and we'll be back with some more news.
Part of a new effort to bring the stories of low-wage workers to light.
Numbers, this is a quote, numbers alone won't help anyone to truly understand what it feels like to live on the economic brink, much less give them a full portrait of who lives there. A blog post on the show's website reads, "That's why we're asking for your help. If you work and you're still fighting to keep your head above water, then we want to hear your story." Well, the show is accepting story submissions in the form of writing, video, or Instagram submissions, and will be accepted. Okay. Selected stories will be featured on the show's website. For the full term submission, click here. So you can go to this blog and check it out. But, you know, people are trying to make it, and this may be a good thing to see. Maybe a good feature if you get MSNBC. So, anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. But I would like to go to, tonight go to this remarkable video and you can go to it as well on the AFL-CIO blog. But what's great about it? I'm trying to get to it here. Excuse me. All right. It's they're excerpts of a new movie. Okay. Coming out. Buzz is building around a new documentary film series called Strength in Union, which is currently being filmed. Covering the history of the labor movement and highlighting the stories of workers, the series also will feature interviews with historians and labor leaders, including Leo Gerard, International President of United Steelworkers, Cliff Guffey, President of the Postal Workers, APWU, American Postal Workers Union, Lawrence Hanley, President of Amalgamated Transit Union, and Captain Lee Moak, President of the Airlines Pilots. And New Hampshire Labor News reports it is likely the series will air on PBS as well as in selected theaters and film festivals. And I listened to this right before the show, and I was very good. And it's about 11 minutes long, but I think it might be, it's a fascinating series of excerpts from the movie, and I'd like you to listen to it. Here we go. It's called Strength in Unity. Is the film?
Well, right now we're confronted with a combination of a very large wave of anti-labor sentiment that's been pumped up. Beginning in the States and now spreading to Canada, primarily by a group of billionaires who have decided that they would be better off if there were no labor unions.
What other country on the planet gives corporations the tax break if they move jobs out of the country?
The United Steelworkers.
Tell me it. Does Germany give you a tax break if you leave Germany? Does France? Does China? Does Japan? Does Brazil? Which country gives you a tax break if you leave the country? Only one. United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, this is where our movement, by the way, needs to do a little bit better, too, on our own end. The way in which that we have sort of allowed the conservative forces, corporate forces, to demonize school teachers, people who work to stop violence in the home of children, who work, you know, who are paid by the government, it is a very conscientious attack by corporate America. And it has one primary motivation. And it's that's the highest unionized sector of the country right now. So they're busy focusing on how to destroy good jobs in the so-called private sector. And they kind of succeed, right? We're at single digits unionization rates in the private sector in America. And then they begin the pivot, which is now they've got to come out against the last highly unionized sector of workers in this country, the last people who are, by the way, mostly women and mostly people of color. The biggest source of good jobs in this country for people of color is in the public sector.
Especially in the 19th century, the Pinkertons were, you know, they had the largest, a larger standing army than the U.S. government at that point. It's a private army that is out there for hire, able to come in and assert themselves. So there was already this pattern out there prior to 1892 of the Pinkertons coming in with Henry Clay Frick and others into the coal fields and the coke fields, into other mills, of pretty much, you know, kind of splitting heads and being very violent rather than coming in to keep the peace.
We had a peculiar institution here that nobody else had called the Coal and Iron Police, which were quasi-state police, but hired by private companies completely and paid for and housed by private companies, but had state power. Nobody else had this, and they were much more dangerous and worse for Pennsylvania. The Pinkertons, they controlled the coal fields in the Mon Valley. They were the ones who were largely the backbone of this 25,000 armed men that U.S. Steel controlled with the coal and irons. And they weren't overthrown till the 30s.
There were 60 people in the room, women and children as well as men, in Oklahoma City, trying to start an oil workers' union. 6 men came in with overcoats on, and they didn't take their overcoats off. They just stood against the back wall. And the organizer leaned over to me and Woody Guthrie, the other singer there. Woody was the extraordinary man who wrote This Land Is Your Land and several thousand other songs. He says, those men don't take off their overcoats. They may have clubs under them. They may be intending to break up the meeting. See if you can get the crowd singing. Well, we did get them all singing, the women and kids too. And they never did break up the meeting. Afterwards, they came forward and said, you know, this is a different kind of a meeting than we were told it was going to be. We were told you were a bunch of communists who wanted to overthrow the government.
There is a rice company in Greenville, Mississippi, used to be known as Uncle Ben's, but now it's the Mars Food Company, and they make candy bars too, not just rice. But they have a temporary worker system where you can work there for 10 years and still be called a temporary worker. And when asked how can you justify keeping someone on as a temporary worker and never making them permanent for 10 years, one of their managers said to me one time, well, that's a job we don't need anyone permanent for. But who do you think you're talking to, and who do you think believes you when you say that? If I work for 10 years, I'm permanent. I'm full-time, and I'm permanent. The difference is I'm not regarded as a real employee. Thus, you don't have to pay me benefits, and you don't have to negotiate with me for a decent wage.
You know, if Mother Jones could face down bayonets, maybe we can do that. And she did. I mean, just one story, I love to relate this story of a man who went to one of her speeches. He had traveled 100 miles by train, and they asked him, why are you here? And he said, well, my son was in a battle in Colorado, and the soldier took out a bayonet and was going to stab him with the bayonet, and Mother Jones stepped right in front of it. And so I wanted to thank her for her bravery. He added, my son was killed later on, but at least at that point, you know, that she saved him. And I thought, what a powerful story about the labor movement, about how people faced this kind of terror.
So the company comes in, it builds housing for the workers, it sets up a school, it sets up a church, but it also runs the church, it runs the school, it runs the housing, it owns the church, it owns the school, and it pays the worker, but it pays the worker in script, not in real wages, in script that the workers can only spend at the company store, where the company sets the cost of the goods. So it creates, under the umbrella of benevolence, a form of paternalism that was more about control than anything else.
George Bear made a statement that the men of labor should basically get down on their knees and thank God for men like us that were here to give you work. This is almost like the divine right of kings that they fought over here before the Magna Carta and what have you over in England. So you had a mindset that we're the ones that put this business together, and they deserve to make a profit. But to what extent you deserve to make a profit, the point here where you have to you subjugate people here to the point where they're slaves. And basically that's what they were. they're kind of in an economic merry-go-round that they couldn't get out of. No schools. Don't build a school in the area, because if you educated your workforce, you'd lose your laboring class.
Got cops, firemen, paramedics out there doing the job for minimum wage. How many of those teachers have a master's degree in education? How many of them have been on the job for 20 years? How many of those cops are laying down their life? How many of those firemen are laying down their life going into a fire or protecting the community as a law enforcement officer, and the paramedics that are out there? This is pretty sinful. This is sinful. It really is.
The issue of unions causing job losses is absolutely ridiculous, and of injuring the economy. The fact of the matter is that as unions are successful in driving wages up and benefits up, there's a corresponding increase in wages and benefits in non-union workplaces.
Out in the Midwest, where I'm from, in Oklahoma, it used to be a Democratic state. Now it's a solid red state.
The president of the American Post.
But you have people who own the newspapers in that area. Just a constant pounding about labor bosses from back east, or like we're criminals or things. And as I said earlier, it's just a total conjecture, a picture that's been painted by the right-wing media and the Chamber of Commerce and different entities, right-to-work committees, saying that, these big bosses up in D.C., they don't care about the average worker. It can't be further than truth. You would not go through the strain and stress that we have as presidents of these large organizations representing people if you truly did not care and worry about the future of the workers in this country.
That right to collective bargaining, that right to try to improve your pay and working conditions is not only important to the union members, but very important to the general public. In fact, it was, I believe, the foundation of the middle class of this country. Right now, we don't have that. And what we're watching is a collapse of the middle class. And I think it's important that individuals understand that they don't need to stand alone, that they can stand together with others and work to improve their lot in life, and that's what they need to do.
Corporate greed. I think the corporations are making a lot of money, and in the past they would negotiate fairly and be able to trickle down that money, that profit money, to the employees. They develop good employees who work really hard at their jobs, and that extra profit is not trickling down anymore. The corporation CEOs make billions of dollars, whereas before they did not, but their workers are working just as hard.
The politicians are eliminating the middle class. If no one can see that, they have to be blind.
Because people are fed up with the way things are going with the government and the way that large corporations and big money people are trying to destroy unions. They're trying to kill us all. And we're just not going to stand for it anymore.
The economy will never get better until middle class people have money in their pockets to purchase things. And until the politicians realize that, then we're just going to be in this lull we've been in for the last 10 years. So somebody's got to get their heads out of their butts and let's get this country moving.
Go buy an American flag. Guess where it's made? In China. Made in India. I mean, they don't buy it. It's everything you see. It's all made somewhere else. What about us people? The people that live in this country.
Don't care for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
I thought that was pretty good, actually. Good show. What I wanted to say is you can go to strengthinunion.org. They are the ones that made this film, I guess. Check that out. We've got another couple minutes, and I wanted to mention the it appears that our esteemed Richard Blumenthal has may find a way to help these poor generations, the last couple generations of students, college students, to help pay for college and get out of debt. So the ominous future of education debt. The bad news on student loans just keeps coming. Within the past few months, federal student loan debt has surpassed the $1.2 trillion mark. Congress raised interest rates for incoming students and tied them to market swings, and the average graduate from the class of 2013 left college with a record $30,000 of debt. Last week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau released a jarring report on outstanding student loan debt and its hazardous effects on our economy. The CFPB, I hate these abbreviations, but the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found that nearly one-fifth of the millions of Americans with federal student loan debt are unable to pay back their loans. A total of 3.4 million people in America are in forbearance, accruing interest while unemployed or suffering financial hardship, while more than 7 million of those former students are in default. This is incredibly problematic. Congress has legislated that, like child support, alimony, and criminal fines, student debt is inescapable in bankruptcy. Unlike borrowers with unmanageable credit card debt, medical debt, mortgage debt, and other loan debt, the millions of Americans who depended on student loans to make an important investment in their future cannot turn to bankruptcy in tough times. Unless these 7 million former students pay back their student loans, debt collectors and government can pursue the debtors, garnish their Social Security payments, wages, tax credits, and refunds, or place liens on their bank accounts and property. The issue is not going away. Roughly one-third of all debt holders are current students. The cost of college is rising quickly, and a bachelor's degree remains important in our economy. And research has found that those young people entering into the real world with outstanding student loan debt defer major purchases and are less likely to buy a home or a car, depressing overall economic activity. President George W. Bush and Barack Obama both introduced initiatives to ease the burden on financially overwhelmed individuals through income-based repayment and pay-as-you-earn plans that cap payments at 15 or 10% of a borrower's income, but respectively, and forgive the remaining balance after 25 or 20 years, respectively. However, only 10.5% of the 15 million Americans currently repaying their loans are enrolled in income-based repayment plans, indicating that many of the borrowers who could be helped by the programs either are not aware of them or are disqualified for other reasons. America's fast-growing student debt problem is hurting our families, damaging our economy, and lowering our quality of life. It demands our attention and our solution. And I'm telling you, folks, it's just downright sick that we allow this to happen. You know, I remember when I went to college, I remember I paid for the college loan myself. I was denied financial aid because I wasn't in debt. Can you imagine that? This was back in the 70s. That they denied me financial aid because they said I wasn't in debt, all right? Well, I worked hard not to be in debt, all right? I was only like 20 or 21 years old, all right? 20 years old, something like that. And but they denied me student financial aid because they said, oh, now you don't have any debt, you know? Well, I said, I do. I have rent. I have a car. I have this and that. He said, yeah, but your income can handle that. I said, well, I don't have any income. I'm, you know, a student. My, oh, man. It was a long,
crazy nightmare. But unless I was thousands and thousands of dollars in debt, I wasn't able to get financial aid. Now, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, you can go, it's crazy. What is the lending criteria, okay, for a student loan, okay, that you can never pay it back? Obviously, since the 15 million people can't pay it back, all right? So it's just an endless cycle, folks, and it's just a scheme to make debt slaves out of these students that are coming out of college, you know? They'll never be able to afford a home. They'll never be able to afford to pay off their debt, all right? And they can't go bankrupt. I mean, or they can, but they can't discharge that debt. So the whole system is insane, and I pity anybody who's trying to go to school right now and paying for it through a student loan program. But anyway, I want to thank everybody tonight who listened. Lyle will be back next week, and please join me tomorrow night when we do another show. And have a good evening. Thanks for listening.